Hi, my name is Mandy Jackson Beverly, and I'm a bibliophile. Welcome to the Bookshop Podcast. Each week, I present interviews with independent bookshop owners from around the globe, authors, and specialists in subjects dear to my heart, the environment and social justice. To help the show reach more people, please share it with friends and family and on social media. And remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. You're listening to episode 208. Opened in 1979 by Otto Penzler, the Mysterious Bookshop is the oldest mystery specialist bookstore in America. Previously located in New York's Midtown, the bookshop now calls Tribeca its home. The Mysterious Bookshop stocks the finest selection of new mystery hardcovers, paperbacks, and periodicals, and also features a superb collection of signed modern first editions, rare collectible hardcovers, and Sherlockiana. Hi, Otto, and welcome to the show. It's great to have you here. I've wanted you on the show for so long.
Thank you so much, Mandy. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's begin with learning about you, where you were born, which I believe is Germany, what brought you to New York, and why you opened the Mysterious Bookshop.
My mother was American, and she just got trapped in Germany during the war. So it took us 5 years to get out and come to New York. And her mother lived in the Bronx. And so we moved in with her for a while. And I lived in the Bronx until I moved into Manhattan in 1978. I had started a little publishing company called The Mysterious Press. I ran it from my apartment in the Bronx, which was fine until it started to have some success. And then I couldn't keep up because it was just me, you know, there was nobody else. And I did everything. And when I say everything, I mean including wrapping the books and taking them to the post office. And so once we started selling too many books, I thought I needed a place in Manhattan with an extra room for an office. You couldn't very well call a secretarial service and say, come up to my apartment in the Bronx.
Yeah, that may have sounded a little odd.
Exactly. So I wound up buying a building, which sounds insane. But my life savings was $2,000. I didn't have any money. I had $2,000. And I wound up buying this building on 56th Street, right behind Carnegie Hall. And it had an apartment in it, and I moved into the apartment. And once I had the building, there was room downstairs, and I thought, wouldn't it be great fun to open a bookshop? I knew nothing about starting a publishing company when I started it, and I knew nothing about running a bookshop when I started it. I made every mistake that is possible for anyone to make. 44 years later, we're still here, not on 56th Street. We're in the new store. We moved down 17 years ago. I still call it the new store. We're in Tribeca now, 4 blocks from the World Trade Center.
And Otto, did you end up buying the building you're in now, or are you renting?
Yeah, we rent this space, which 17 years ago, because it was not too long after 9/11, nobody wanted to be in this neighborhood because we were 4 blocks from the World Trade Center, and it was like a war zone, and everybody was moving out. But I couldn't afford rents in Midtown; it was impossible. And so this place was available. It was totally raw. We put in electricity, plumbing, heating, air conditioning. Everything we had to put in, and the rent was very reasonable back then, but it goes up every year. It's not so reasonable now.
Yeah, that's unfortunately what I'm hearing from many booksellers throughout the world. Anyone in a major city, they're saying, if you can buy the building, because rents are so expensive. And I'm sure the cost of buying a building in Tribeca is cost prohibitive.
Now, who could afford it? I couldn't afford a building. I couldn't afford it then, but I could buy one for $2,000 down. The whole price was $177,000 for a 6-story building right behind Carnegie Hall.
And do you still own that building?
Oh, no, no. We had to, I had a partner in it to help, because with renovations and so on, we needed to do a lot of work. So he became a partner. And he reached and the age where he wanted to cash in and retire. So, and I couldn't afford his half. So we sold the building. I made more money in real estate on that building than I have as a bookseller.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. But, you know, I had to move out of the building because the new owners wanted the space for themselves. My then wife and I got an apartment and paid all the fees that are connected to selling real estate in New York. And I wound up actually owing about $50,000, despite all the money that we made from selling the building, because renovating the space down here was very, very costly.
And you're still publishing under the name Mysterious Press. Is that an imprint of Penzler Publishers?
It is. Not the same thing, but it is part of it. Penzler Publishers was kind of me restructuring our publishing company because I had started an e-publishing company about 12 years ago that's distributed by Open Road. And then we started something called American Mystery Classics, which is reissuing in hardcover and paperback and ebook some of the great American mystery crime novels of the golden age, the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And then we started a company devoted to psychological suspense called Scarlet. And now we've just started. We haven't quite announced it yet because we have seven books under contract, but only one ready to go called Crime Inc., which is true crime. But instead of having five separate companies, I restructured to make Penzler Publishers. And then each of those companies now is an imprint at Penzler Publishers.
Well, congratulations. You have accomplished a lot.
Thank you.
I admire and appreciate your dedication to the genre. And I've no doubt every crime writer, mystery writer around the globe wants to be your friend.
Yes, many are very close friends. There are a lot of very good acquaintances as well, and a couple who were never friends and are never going to be.
Yeah, I think most of us have a few people like that in our lives. Let's talk about the mystery genre. What do you think helped elevate it? And has the changing social structure in the United States shifted the popularity of mystery novels and the people who read them? And did you see a rise in mystery readers during the pandemic?
You raised about four interesting things that will take the rest of the podcast to answer properly. But in the first place, yes, mysteries have become very, very popular, but they always have been very popular. They were popular in the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s and so on, and they remain popular. More people read books during the pandemic than ever before. They couldn't travel. They couldn't go to the theater. They couldn't go to movies. They couldn't do so many things, so they stayed home and read. Our e-publishing company, our sales went up about 60% during the downtime of COVID. It was the best business that we had ever done. And after COVID ended in 2021, the bookshop had its best year ever. After 2020 was its worst year after the first few, which were horrible, which were really a struggle. So there are more people reading mysteries, but there are more people reading in general, I think. Certainly there were during the year or two of COVID when so much was closed to us. Now to your question about how has some of the changes in the country affected mystery fiction. Well, mystery fiction really is fiction. You know, it's a genre. It's a group of books, but it's in many ways it's very much like the rest of fiction of novels and books in general. A major change in the last decade has been the number of Black writers, Hispanic writers, writers in translation from countries that never wrote mysteries and suddenly are being translated. So, you know, the general demographic has followed that trend to some degree. There are more Black readers than there used to be. There are more readers who where English may not be their first language, or they may not have been born here and fully regard themselves as Americans. So suddenly they're seeing books being translated or published by English-speaking people in, say, Africa. There are a lot of African crime novels that have come to the United States, which we never saw until a very few years ago. So when those books are being published, it's a chicken and egg thing. They're being published, so it's attracting readers that may not have been reading mystery fiction before. But since there are now lots of those readers, publishers are doing more books for those readers. So more books like that are being published. Marginalized writers have had a major impact on the reading public and sales in the last few years, very few years.
Yeah, we definitely saw a push with publishers publishing books in translation during the pandemic, along with more diverse voices. I find this exciting. So kudos to the agents and publishers recognizing the need for these books to be on bookshelves. What I love about books in translation is understanding the writer's style, the non-lyrical or lyrical form of each sentence.
Yeah, the cadences are different. The language is, yes, it's English, but it has a different cadence. And sometimes it takes getting used to. You know, for many years, it was well known, it was well established that you could only write mystery fiction if you lived in a democratic country with an elected leader. Because if you lived under a dictatorship, whether it was Russia or China or Nazi Germany or fascist Italy or Tsarist Russia, you know, all of those countries that lived under totalitarian states, you could not write mystery fiction because the police were not there to protect you. They were the people that you were afraid of. So it would be almost impossible for somebody living under a totalitarian state to say, oh, I want to write a mystery novel. I want to write a detective story. It just wouldn't happen. So mysteries were almost exclusively being written by Americans and British writers and the French, who had a democratic government. Now, many of the countries that we're seeing books coming from, being translated here, have had more democratic governments than they did 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 150 years ago.
And that takes us back to the shifting social structure. And I'm always intrigued by the way the arts are affected by this.
Yeah. When we had translated books until fairly recently, and there are always exceptions to everything. There are one or two books that were published by Japanese writers, for example, who did not live in a democratic society, but a few of those made it into America. But we had a very popular following for Scandinavian books, starting 25 years ago or so, or maybe even longer than that as outliers. My Show Wall and Per Valu, for example, wrote 10, the Swedish couple who wrote 10 Swedish novels about Martin Beck. And they said Showall was a poet and Valu was a general novelist. And they decided to collaborate on this series of detective stories. And they said, but we'll only do 10. And they did 10. And just as the 10th was finished, Valu died. So everyone has always said, you should have said 20.
Yes, exactly. And now look at all the Scandinavian shows that are being produced for TV.
Yes, they're everywhere. Yeah.
When you look at the history of female mystery writers, such as Mary Shelley, Meta Fuller-Victor, and Agatha Christie, to the female mystery writers today, did you ever see a dwindling and a surge with these female mystery writers? Or do you think there's always been a balance with female mystery writers and male mystery writers?
Women have been writing mysteries from the beginning. You know, I mean, the best-selling mystery writer in America for 25 years was Mary Roberts Rinehart. She outsold Agatha Christie. So, you know, we're reissuing her books in the American Mystery Classic series. So we called her, and she, as she was defined back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, the American Agatha Christie. But the fact is, she outsold Agatha Christie. So I've always said, no, Agatha Christie is the American Mary Roberts Reinhardt.
So why don't we hear more about her work?
Well, because she wasn't nearly, I mean, to be totally candid, even though I'm publishing her and I love her books, I love selling her books too, she wasn't as good as Agatha Christie. She just wasn't as good. But there were always lots of female mystery writers, some of whom were just like male mystery writers, some of whom were dreadful, and some of whom were terrific. You know, Mary Roberts Reinhardt in America, but also Dorothy B. Hughes, who was one of the first hard-boiled women writers, was very successful in the 1940s and 50s. Obviously, of course, Dorothy Sayers was very successful starting in the 1930s. And they weren't alone. There were other women, Niall Marsh, who was a New Zealand writer, who was very popular starting in the 1930s also. Charlotte Armstrong was a great American suspense writer who's had several films made from her books, as has Dorothy B. Hughes. Yeah, and there were 19th century female writers. I mean, Catherine Green is famous in America for being the mother or the grandmother of detective fiction in the United States. She was the first novel or among the first novelists. There are several Mrs. Eden Southworth, who you've never heard of, but was very prolific and was writing in the 1870s, before Anna Catherine Green, but nobody reads her anymore because, in all candor, they're unreadable. They're just awful. So there's no sudden discovery of female mystery writers. They've always been there. They've always had successful careers. Maybe not as many as men, but not as disparate as one might think.
Do you think there has been a surge in female mystery writers of late?
Yes, I think so. Although, you know, I can think of so many male mystery writers who have come along lately in the last 10 years or 20 years, just as there have been a lot of female mystery writers. Maybe more women than men, but I think more women are being reviewed in general than men for all kinds of books in very recent years, as the country has become more woke, deciding that we really ought to be paying more attention to people of color, of female writers, and so on, leaving poor white male writers out in the cold. Oh, the hate mail will be coming in any minute now.
Oh, my goodness. In last week's episode, I spoke about my views on feminism and the feminist movement. I won't repeat myself here, but I'll make sure to put the link to last week's episode in the show notes for anyone who's interested. I grew up in Australia, which at the time was a male chauvinist country. I had a great-great aunt who lived in Australia, and she was an incredible artist, but she wasn't accepted because she was a female, so she drew under a male pseudonym. I'm fascinated by the treatment of women in the arts throughout history, and stories like my great-great-aunt's make my heart ache.
When I was young, and then we really can get to a different subject, but when I was young, I was astonished that that there were so few women doctors. I thought that women would make better doctors than men, and I thought, somebody should be doing something about this. I don't know how you do it, but something should change. So I was an early feminist, too.
Well, thank you for that, Otto. It is appreciated. Now let's get back to the bookshop. Mysterious Press publishes a bibliomystery series, limited edition hard copies signed by the author lettered copies, paperbacks only available in the Mysterious Bookshop, and ebook copies through your digital imprint, mysteriouspress.com. So I would love to know more about your publishing. What was the impetus for publishing the Bibliomystery series?
What you just talked about are not Mysterious Press books. They're published by the Mysterious Bookshop. They are proprietary publishing, meaning that they're being published by my bookshop for sale in my bookshop. You cannot buy one of my Bibliomysteries at Amazon or Barnes & Noble or even other independents, except a couple of mystery stores that I'm very friendly with, and they buy some of those too. So just to define what that is, a lot of people have no idea what a bibliomystery is. I'm constantly being asked, like, what is that? So bibliomystery is a mystery in which the world of books is featured, whether it's set at a bookshop or a library, or involves a collector of rare books, or a rare book itself, or a bookseller, an archivist. All of those serve as a background for a mystery story. And I have been commissioning for about 10 years now, original stories, minimum of 10,000 words, that are bibliomysteries. And we've got about 50 books in the series by many, many major writers who have been nice enough to write for this series. And we publish them in the store in very handsome little books. We do 100 copies in hardcover that are numbered and signed by the author for real collectors. And then we do them in paperback at very reasonable prices. But we also do put them out as ebooks, where you can get them on Amazon or Kindle, or all those reader things. Even though I own and run an e-publishing company, I don't have a reader. I read physical books. I don't have a Kindle or an iPad or all those things. No, I read real books. So so I'm very proud of those. Those are really great. One of them, written by John Connolly, won the Edgar as the best short story of the year. As the limited editions that you mentioned, again, we publish only in the bookshop. I'm doing the complete Jack Reacher by Lee Child. We have done 18 books in that series. They're limited to 100 copies. They're very expensive for collectors. They're $150, but they're beautifully bound in marbled boards with leather spines stamped in gold. And Lee has written a new introduction to each of the books, talking about the book, the idea that generated the book, where he was, what he was writing, you know, what he was thinking about at the time. It's a wonderful series. But we also have done limited editions like that with Michael Connelly, Elmore Leonard, Dennis Lehane, John Banville, James Elroy, and others. I can't remember all of them right off the top of my head. Because I collected books for so long, I became, as a real collector, I helped the store make life easier for collectors. I gave them opportunities, and we feature signed books. Like, everybody comes to sign at my store.
And you have a lot of events in the bookshop.
We do a lot of events. Yeah, we're doing three this week. You know, Lawrence Block is coming in tonight. We had Megan Abbott and Allison Galen. So we do about 100 a year because I like signed books. I wanted to get all of my books signed. So I thought my customers would like that too. So we started to really focus on getting books signed. And now it's become a bit of a curse. If we don't get an author in to sign, we can't sell a book.
You've created a monster.
Yeah.
You bring up a good point, Otto, because during the last couple of years, I've spoken with quite a few rare and collectible bookshop owners, along with Stephanie Stilo at the Library of Congress. And what they've all told me is that if you're interested in starting a book collection of rare books or signed copies, is to buy the books you want to read. Buy what excites you. What are your thoughts on this?
That's a very, very difficult question. It sounds like a one-sentence question with a one-sentence answer, and there isn't. What I can generally say is you should be collecting what you like. That's the most important element. If you're doing it as an investment, you're making a dreadful mistake. Rare books have turned out to be a really great investment, but it's not based on, I think this author is going to have great returns. You buy great books, but mostly they come from a different era when the print runs were smaller. I mean, I look at authors now who are collected, for example, Michael Connelly and obviously Lee Child as well. Their books are collected, but their later books are never going to be valuable. Never. Because they're printed in such huge quantities. You know, there's the new first printing of a Michael Connelly book is probably 500,000 copies. It'll never be rare. You know, the first book had a relatively small printing, just like the first Lee Child had a relatively small printing. So if you want somebody that you really like and you want to collect their books, it's not very expensive. It's not hard to do. First couple of books are costlier, but they're not a fortune, and you can do it. You know, one of the things I talk about collecting a lot, you know, we sell a lot of rare books in my store. I have full-time people on staff here, but I'm the one who handles the rare books because it's a great passion of mine. I collected for 55 years. And so I know the rare books really well, and I loved collecting them. And I love collecting for one of my customers. You know, if one of my customers says, this is the kind of book I want. We had customers who, for example, wanted books with a magic background, with magicians. I loved finding books for them, or books set in a certain place. You know, I have a wonderful customer who is putting together a great collection of books set in California or written by California writers. He's collecting for a university library, and he's been a fabulous customer. And I'm finding books that he didn't know were set in California, or he didn't know the writer was a Californian, but I like doing the research for it and helping him. And some of those books are next to nothing, you know, because they're not famous, they're not important books, but so they're very inexpensive. And prices of books are really based on the most fundamental basis of capitalism, which is supply and demand. You know, there are rare Bibles from the mid 19th century that there are very few copies around, but nobody cares. The same with certain sermons that were even published in the 18th century. And they're very few, but they're very inexpensive because nobody cares. Whereas something like James Bond or Sherlock Holmes, you can find most of them pretty much anytime you want to. But they're very expensive because so many people want them. So yes, trying to collect based on the return on investment would be a dreadful mistake. Collect what you like.
Well, I think the consensus is in, and everybody who collects books agrees with you wholeheartedly. Collect the books you enjoy reading. Okay, I would love to hear about your crime clubs and your American Mystery Classic subscriptions.
The American Mystery Classics is a series, as I think I mentioned, where we're reissuing in hardcover and paperback the great books of the Golden Age: Ellery Queen, John Dixon Carr, Mary Roberts Reinhardt, Earl Stanley Gardner, all those people who are available as ebooks, but not in very attractive hardcover books and trade paperbacks. So that's Pensel Publishers. That's AMC, American Mystery Classics, and we have clubs in my bookshop where people sign up and they get autographed first editions every month. We pick the books. We read very carefully, especially for the first mystery club. We have eight clubs altogether. For the main club, we have the major writers. So every month you're going to get a Michael Connelly. You're going to get a Lee Child when he was still writing them. You'll get a Louise Penny, you know, you'll get major writers. And everybody has liked those. We've had over the years, Robert B. Parker, Sue Grafton, Dick Francis. Well, you know, when they were around, they were always clubs because they were the most popular writers in my store. So the most popular writers, they get the main club, but we have a first mystery club where most of the staff is reading on a regular basis to try to find books that we think are going to appeal to a lot of people. But we also have a hard-boiled club for people who like private eye novels, hard-boiled stuff. We have a traditional mystery club for people who like cozier books, more, you know, Agatha Christie-type books. We have a British club where we import signed first editions from the UK and offer those. We have an unclassifiable club, which are books that are almost mysteries. They're not really detective novels, they're not really private eye, they're not really traditional, but they have a lot of elements of crime. Sometimes they're general literature with some crime in it. Sometimes they'll have some elements of fantasy or science fiction, but always connected to crime. So that's also a popular club. And you can subscribe to the American Mystery Classic series And people who subscribe to that get a discount on the books. They get a 20% discount. But we don't charge extra for guaranteeing a first edition and signed.
And can people still sign up for this limited edition series?
It depends on the author. There are some authors who are more collected than others. Even if they're not as popular as some writers, there are some very popular writers who aren't particularly collected. And I'm not sure I know why, but they're just not. So when we do 100 copies of anything, whether it's the Bibliomystery series or the limited edition series, we have some standing orders. It tends to be about 40 to 50 copies. And then after that, people who want it every time we do one, they want the book, and they get priority because they have a standing order. But after that, it's first come, first served, and there's usually 40 or 50. We announce it. We have a weekly newsletter. You may have seen that, which is free to everybody, and there's no obligation. Anybody can sign up to get the newsletter. And we announce that we're going to have this coming out in a Bibliomystery. We're going to have this coming out in a limited edition, and so on. So people can order in advance and not get shut out.
And it's so good that you ship worldwide.
We do, yeah. Almost from the beginning, we had customers in Shanghai. We had customers in Ceylon. We had a great customer in Cyprus. Of course, England, we have a lot of customers in England. But in Scandinavia, too, and Japan, we have several very good customers in Japan. Iceland. Ragnar Jonasson, the wonderful Icelandic writer, is a very good customer in the store. He collects rare books.
That makes sense, right? Now, as an experienced editor and reader and collector of books and the owner of Mysterious Bookshop, what books would you suggest young writers interested in the genre read so that they can really understand the genre of mystery and thrillers?
You ask very difficult questions, Mandy, I have to say.
Oh, I'm sorry. I like to keep things interesting, and I'm a curious person.
There is no style for writing a crime thriller, because there are so many different styles. You know, Agatha Christie and Dashiell Hammett did not have similar styles at all. So it depends on the kind of book that a writer is working on, the kind of book that a writer wants to write. If somebody wants to write traditional mysteries, study Agatha Christie. You know, if you want to write hard-boiled crime fiction, study Raymond Chandler. Study Robert B. Parker or Ross MacDonald. They'll teach you how to write. Study Mickey Spillane, who is just an incredibly compelling writer. Once you start one of his books, you can't stop. So those are the people to study. But I would also recommend getting a few books on writing, about writing. And maybe the best is there's one by Stephen King, which may be the best book on writing that I've ever seen. Patricia Highsmith wrote a very good one, writing suspense fiction, I think was the correct title for that. And it's excellent. She knew how to write suspense fiction, and she knew how to describe it. A lot of writers, some successful writers, some unsuccessful writers, have written books about writing. And I would certainly read several books by a writer whose style you like. Listen, Robert B. Parker read Chandler and Hammett and Ross MacDonald. When he started writing his books, he was emulating Ross MacDonald. And Ross MacDonald, when he started writing, was emulating Raymond Chandler. So they became great writers on their own, but they first were learning to write by copying, and that's a too strong a word, they're not copying, but being inspired by writers that they admired. And I think that's a great way to learn. And read.
Yes, I totally agree. Every good writer is an avid reader. It's part of the job description.
Yes. I mean, and it's hard. Listen, I can't do it. I'm a really good editor, in all humility. And I've been editing books for a very long time. And I've edited books by some of the greatest writers of the last 50 years, which has been a great privilege to me, a great honor to be able to do that. And I could take a wonderful, a great, great writer and make their book better by being a very careful and meticulous editor. But I can't write the way they write. And I've read all their books. I read a lot of books in my life in this field. I can't do it. But I don't have the urge to do it either. I did when I was very young. I thought I was going to write great novels when I was 16. But I now have read enough to know that no matter, I can write an English sentence. I've written a lot of books and I've written a lot of articles and so on. I know how to write a good declarative sentence, but I can't create characters that make people care about them. That's a gift that some people have. And you know, I do a lot of conference, not a lot, but I've done some conferences where people want to learn how to write. They come and they give me pages, which I read, and then I give them guidance on those pages. And one writer, this gentleman who was so dedicated to writing, and he was so wanting to do it. He was probably about 60 years old and had been trying for 30 years. And working at it day and night, day and night, day and night. And I read it and I said, you know, you're just not a good writer. I broke his heart. You know, I know you want to, and you're working hard, and you have the basics. You know how to write a sentence, you know, the way I do. But I can't write a novel, and I'm not sure that you can, because I don't care about your character. It's harsh. You know, there was a woman at a conference, and I read her pages, and I said, do you paint by any chance? And she said, no, I don't paint. I said, do you play a musical instrument? And she said, no. Why are you asking? I said, well, obviously you have a creative drive, a creative impulse, and you can't write. You should do something else. And I met my wife at a mystery conference. She had written some pages, and I had edited before I met her, before I saw that she was one of the most beautiful blondes I have ever seen in my life. She would bring tears to your eyes. She was so beautiful. And she stuck her head into this room where I was waiting for her. And she said, hi, I'm Lisa. Please don't make me cry.
Oh.
And I know, it's so cute. And I said, no, what do you mean? And then she came in, she told me she had met that woman that I had said, you can't write. And Lisa said, Otto Penzler is going to be editing my manuscript. And she said, he made me cry. He's a monster. You should stay away from him. He's a monster.
My goodness, that sounds like it's becoming a horror story.
Yeah, I know.
This is an excellent time to remind new writers that there is gold in having your book edited by a professional editor. I learned the hard way. It wasn't until my book 3 or 4 that I found a team of editors that I grooved with and respected. And when you find fabulous editors, it is so exciting.
Exciting the other way. It's exciting for an editor to work with a good writer too.
Oh, I love that, Otto.
I get to work with Joyce Carol Oates.
Wow, that's pretty exciting.
And I've been publishing Joyce for about almost 20 years, and she almost never needs editing at all. She is such a professional. And the very first book I did with her, I was very intimidated. It's Joyce Carol Oates, right? So, and who am I to tell Joyce Carol Oates how to write? But the first book we did together, it needed a lot of work. And I was a coward. I couldn't call her to tell her that. And so finally she called and said, did you read the book that I sent? And I said, yes, I did. And she said, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I think it needs some work. And she said, well, what do you think it needs? And I told her, and it meant a major rewrite. And there was this dead silence, which lasted 3 weeks, 4 weeks. And finally she said, yes, you're right. Of course. What else? And then from there, it was easy the rest of the way. But I was scared to death. I was trembling. I was so nervous. But now, if I could edit Joyce Carol Oates, I can edit anybody, because she is so great. She is in a class by herself.
Yes, she is. Okay, what are you currently reading?
It's hard for me. It's harder for me to read than it used to be. In a couple of weeks, I turn 81, and so my reading has slowed down quite a bit. I edit two anthologies every year, best mystery stories of the year. And so I read a lot of short stories for that, as I have for 27 years. It used to be Best American Mystery Stories of the Year, which I did for Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. But now it's Best Mystery Stories of the Year, which I do for the Mysterious Press. And then I also edit an anthology called Golden Age Detective Stories, Golden Age Biblio Mysteries, Golden Age Lock Room Mysteries. The one I've just finished working on is Golden Age Whodunits. So I read a lot of stories for that as well. And I still read some manuscripts. I read, of course, Joyce. I read everything that she writes. Thomas Perry is another one of my great, great writers. I'm expecting any minute to get the next book by James Comey. I just published his first crime novel, Central Park West. And which, thank you, I'm just knocking wood, but it's been very successful. Really good writer. So a first novel, it's unbelievably good for a first novel, for any novel, but especially for a first novel. And I'm expecting that to be his second book to be delivered any minute, and I will drop everything and read that.
While we're speaking of books, I recently received a copy of The Murder Wheel by Tom Meade, which is published by The Mysterious Press. So I look forward to reading it, and I've got to say the cover is absolutely exquisite. Otto, I've thoroughly enjoyed chatting with you today. You are a well of information. I'm glad we were able to make this conversation happen. I was concerned it never would.
So am I. I'm glad you were persistent.
And thank you for doing all you do to support these fabulous authors and reading.
It's my pleasure and my job. So thanks again for having me. Take care.
You've been listening to my conversation with Otto Penzler from The Mysterious Bookshop and The Mysterious Press. To find out more about the Bookshop Podcast, go to thebookshoppodcast.com. And make sure to subscribe and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. You can also follow me at Mandy Jackson Beverly and the Bookshop Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and on YouTube at the Bookshop Podcast. If you have a favorite indie bookshop that you'd like to suggest we have on the podcast, I'd love to hear from you via the contact form at thebookshoppodcast.com. The Bookshop Podcast is written and produced by me, Mandy Jackson Beverly. Theme music provided by Brian Beverly, executive assistant to Mandy, Adrian Otterhahn, and graphic design by Francis Farala. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.